donkey on a baby donkey. The Septuagint text reads, literally, on an ass and a new foal, meaning a very young baby donkey. The original Hebrew reads, on an ass, on a young male ass, the child of a female ass, which was probably originally a poetic idiom for just young male donkey, but if taken literally, would seem to say, on a donkey and a baby donkey, and that is how Matthew took it. As Marcus Borg observes, these, quote, changes indicate a human author at work who felt free to modify the story he received, end quote. And so we have to ask, quote, are the two animals in Matthew's story history remembered? Obviously not. Clearly the second animal is there not because Matthew had better historical information on the basis of which to correct Mark, end quote, but because Matthew wanted to make the connection to Zechariah explicit and more literal. Hence, quote, it is an instance of prophecy historicized, that is, a passage from the Hebrew Bible regarded as prophecy is generating details in the gospel narrative that are then reported as an event in the gospel, which is not only a characteristic of Matthew, but also a factor shaping the development of the gospel tradition and the New Testament as a whole, end quote. But that means the whole gospel could be prophecy historicized, not history remembered. It's already clear Matthew does not care about getting the historical facts right. He does not compare sources or investigate what happened. He just makes up what he wants or feels is needed. Matthew also completely destroys Mark's own beautiful literary structure by moving things around. For example, the Sabbath controversies are bumped from Mark 2 into Matthew 12. And adding or subtracting details and packing in long sections of new teaching, such as the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5-7 and the Olive Mount parables in Matthew 24-25, but Matthew recycles the pieces of Mark to create large-scale structure of his own, as discovered and demonstrated by Dale Allison and others. For example, after Matthew introduces Jesus' ministry, he adds a fivefold division of sections by repeating five times the complete phrase, quote, and it happened when Jesus had finished, end quote. Matthew 7, verse 28-29, 11, verse 1, 13, verse 53, 19, verse 1, and 26, verse 1. Each phrase ends an extended insertion of discourse that Matthew has added to the teachings of Mark, though in some cases incorporating and transforming Markan teachings. As Matthew's aim was to greatly expand the teachings in Mark and make them more strict and more firmly Jewish, his overall structure reflects this intent, using those five repeated catchphrases to alternate between narrative and discourse. We start with Matthew 1-4, a narrative section, the introduction of birth, baptism, and ministry. Then we get to Matthew 5-7, a discourse section, where Jesus' demands upon Israel are stated, ending with the key phrase. Then we get to Matthew 8-9, another narrative section, Jesus' deeds within and for Israel. Then Matthew 10, our second discourse section, teaching the disciples how to do the same, which ends again with the key phrase. Then Matthew 11-12 is another narrative section, Israel's negative response. Then we get to Matthew 13, the third discourse section, where we find an explanation of Israel's negative response, ending again with that key phrase. Then Matthew 14-17, yet another narrative section, the founding of the church, followed by Matthew 18, the fourth discourse narrative, the teaching for the church, ending again with that key phrase. Then Matthew 19-22, a narrative section, entering Judea and ending in Jerusalem, is followed by Matthew 23-25, the fifth discourse section, on the future judgment and salvation, yet again ending with that key phrase. Then finally, the last narrative section, Matthew 26-28, the conclusion, the betrayal, crucifixion, and resurrection. There are shorter teachings interspersed in the narrative sections, but unlike Mark, Matthew inserts these five special long discourse sections, called the five great discourses, in this overall structure. But like Mark, Matthew has also crafted his gospel into a large chiastic superstructure. We start with A, the genealogy, a summary of past times in Matthew 1, verses 1-17, which parallels A, the Great Commission, a summary of future times in Matthew 28, verses 16-20. Then B, Mary, the first Mary, an angel arrives, and the birth of Jesus in Matthew 1, verses 18-25, parallels B, Mary, second Mary, an angel arrives, and the resurrection of Jesus, Matthew 28, verses 1-15. Then we have C, gifts of wealth at birth, the Magi, and attempt to thwart the birth, Herod, Matthew 2 verses 1 to 12. That parallels C, gift of wealth at death, Joseph of Arimathea, attempt to thwart resurrection, Sanhedrin and the guards, in Matthew 27 verses 57 to 66. Then we have D, flight to Egypt, woe to the children, Jeremiah laments the destruction of the first temple, in Matthew 2 verses 13 to 21. That parallels D, march to Jerusalem, woe to the children, Jesus predicts destruction of the second temple, in Matthew 21 verse 1 to 27 verse 56. Then we have E, Judea avoided, in Matthew 2 verses 22 to 23, parallels E, Judea entered, in Matthew 19 verse 1 to Matthew 20 verse 34. Then we have F, the baptism of Jesus, Matthew 3 verse 1 and on. That parallels F, the transfiguration of Jesus, Matthew 16 verse 13 and on. Then we have G, crossing of the sea twice, Matthew 8 to 11. That parallels G, crossing the sea twice again in Matthew 14 and on. Then we have H, John's ministry in Matthew 11, parallels John's death in Matthew 14. Then we have I, the rejection of Jesus in Matthew 11, parallels I, the rejection of Jesus again in Matthew 13. Then we have J, secrets are revealed through Jesus in Matthew 11. That parallels J, secrets are revealed through Jesus again in Matthew 13. Then we have K, attack of the Pharisees in Matthew 12. Parallels K, condemnation of the Pharisees, later in Matthew 12. And right in the middle of these concentric parallels, the Pharisees determine to kill God's servant, right in the middle of chapter 12. Within this overall structure are several substructures that certify the larger one. For example, the F segments, the baptism of Jesus, which is paired with the transfiguration of Jesus, parallel each other in a common structure. In the baptism ministry, we have the preliminary setting, John's witness, in Matthew 3, verses 1 to 12, corresponds to the transfiguration ministry, where we have the preliminary setting of Peter's witness, in Matthew 16, verses 13 to 28. Then, in the baptism ministry, we have the revelation of the Son. Then, in the transfiguration ministry, we again have the revelation of the Son, which also has a reference back to John. Then in the baptism ministry, we have Satan resisted. Then in the transfiguration ministry, we have Satan cast out. Then in the baptism ministry, we have his removal to Capernaum. Then in the transfiguration ministry, once again, his removal to Capernaum. In the baptism ministry, we then have the recruiting of disciples and the beginning of the ministry, and the Sermon on the Mount, in part about forgiveness. And then we have faith and worship produce healing, and then what the disciples must give up. This all parallels right after the transfiguration ministry, Jesus' sermon on discipleship, faith, recruiting, and forgiveness. Matthew has also recrafted the crucifixion narrative specifically to be more elegantly chiastic than Mark's version. We start with A, Passover and crucifixion in Matthew 26 verses 1 to 2, which parallels A, Passover and resurrection in Matthew 28 verses 1 to 10. Then we have B, priests plotting, in Matthew 26 verses 3 to 5, which parallels B, priests plotting again, in Matthew 27 verses 62 to 66. Then we have C, Jesus anointed for burial, in Matthew 26 verses 6 to 13, which parallels C, Jesus is buried, in Matthew 27 verses 57 to 61. Then we have D, preparations. Judas is enlisted, the Passover is prepared, Matthew 26 verses 14 to 19. That parallels D, results. Jesus' lordship is confirmed, and the least are faithful. Matthew 27 verses 52 to 56. Then we have E, Judas is exposed. In Matthew 26 verses 20 to 25, that parallels E, the temple is exposed. Matthew 27 verse 51. Then we have F, the Lord's Supper, a mock death, is inaugurated. Matthew 26 verses 26 to 28. That parallels F, the crucifixion and death, Matthew 27, verses 35 to 50. Then we have G, the Nazirite vow is made, Matthew 26, verse 29. That parallels G, Nazirite vow is fulfilled, Matthew 27, verse 34. Then we have H, his removal to Olivet, Matthew 26, verse 30. That parallels H, his removal to Golgotha, Matthew 27, verses 32 to 33. Then we have I, abandonment, Matthew 26, verses 31 to 35. That parallels I, mockery, Matthew 27, verses 27 to 31. Then we have J, Jesus asks God not to be released, Matthew 26, verses 36 to 46. That parallels J, Pilate does not release Jesus, Matthew 27, verses 11 to 26. Then we have K, Judas betrays Jesus, Matthew 26, verses 47 to 56, which parallels K, Judas hangs himself, Matthew 27, verses 3 to 10. Then we have L, the trial before the Sanhedrin, Matthew 26, verses 57 to 68, which parallels L, the Sanhedrin delivers Jesus to Pilate, Matthew 27, verses 1 to 2. And right in the middle of all these concentric parallels is M, the denial of Peter, Matthew 26, verses 69 to 75. It was necessary for Christ's sacrifice that he be completely abandoned by men, so his humbling would be thorough, as is stated in Philippians 2, verses 7 to 8. And so Peter's denial is essential to the story. Accordingly, Matthew makes it the centerpiece of his Passover chiasmus. Of course, much of this could be explained away as Matthew just creatively rearranging facts to fit his literary design, although even that entails accepting that Matthew doesn't really care all that much about the facts. Getting history straight is not his concern. Creating an elegantly symbolic literary structure is. But it is very unlikely that history worked out so well to begin with, generating all the right facts that Matthew could arrange in this way. He certainly had to invent some things to get it all to fit. And a lot, of course, he got from Mark, and we already saw how the status of those details as facts is already in question, since many of them, if not all of them, were invented by Mark to suit his aims. Thus, Matthew could take invented details from Mark and add invented details of his own to produce a completely invented gospel narrative, whose literary design has completely eclipsed any interest in historical truth. For example, Matthew adds the otherwise pointless and inexplicable detail at the beginning that, quote, they shall call his name Emmanuel, which means God is with us, end quote, Matthew 1, verse 23. Even though that never happens, Jesus is not named Emmanuel and never so called anywhere in the ensuing story. This weird detail only makes sense because Matthew concludes his story by having Jesus declare, quote, I am with you, end quote, Matthew 28, verse 20. Matthew has thus consciously invented material to parallel the end with the beginning and thereby communicate a fundamental concept of the Christian gospel. But as we've seen, this is just a small piece of a large and complex structure organizing Matthew's entire gospel. None of this can really have been orally transmitted. The kind of detailed and intricate structure, just like Mark's, can only really be crafted, preserved, and understood using a written text. Yet Matthew and Mark rearranged everything to create their own unique texts. This means there was no transmitted structure or order. These authors are inventing it. And since they are also freely inventing details to suit their structures, why should we believe they are not freely inventing all of it? Even if some of it comes from elsewhere, what elements are those? We cannot tell. And even if we could tell, what reason have we to believe that that wasn't invented too by earlier authors? None, really. Maybe some of it goes back to the original revelations from the Lord received by apostles such as Paul or Peter, but even if that's the case, those are still not from a historical Jesus, but a dreamed or hallucinated Jesus. The complex and deliberate structures of Mark and Matthew show that there was no narrative into which these sayings were placed, because they each freely created one of their own, and inserted and rearranged sayings in different ways to suit their own aims, as we'll see Luke did too. As we saw in 1 Clement in chapter 8, and we'll see in Paul in the next chapter, it would seem that for a long time there were no narratives associated with Jesus, other than what the apostles hallucinated or pretended to, or what they reconstructed from ancient scriptures. So there is no case to be made that any of the sayings of Jesus that might go back to the beginning of the cult don't come from revelations rather than a Galilean ministry, because the Galilean ministry was clearly a gospel add-on, originated by Mark, to pair his Palestinian adventure with a sea of sufficient size to use as his preferred metaphor. The same goes for the deeds. The miracle stories and other events all have obvious symbolic and mythical roles to play in Matthew's story, just as in Mark's. There's no reason to believe any of those things happened, either. In every case, if it's not already an implausible event used to illustrate a literary and theological point, like, as we saw earlier, the clearing of the temple, it could easily just be a model for missionaries to follow or cite in their ongoing work, like the healings and exorcisms. In fact, most of the sections Matthew adds or changes deal with missionary activity and how to run the church or how to live in it, and thus reflect interests that would have primarily arisen and been worked out after Jesus had died, and thus are most likely later creations and not original to Jesus. Even the narrative sections have allegorical functions in the same direction. For example, in the fourth narrative unit, Dale Allison observes, quote, that the ecclesia is indeed the most important subject of Matthew 14-17 appears not only from the ever-increasing focus upon the disciples as opposed to the crowds, but also from Peter's being the rock upon which the church is built, because it is precisely in this section that Peter comes to the fore. Among the insertions into the Markan material are these four passages: Matthew 14 verses 28 to 33, Peter walks on the water; Matthew 15 verse 15, Peter asks a question; Matthew 16 verses 13 to 20, Jesus blesses Peter; Matthew 17 verses 24 to 27, Peter asks a question again and answers a question. Peter's emerging preeminence thus correlates with the emergence of the church. Matthew 18, the next major discourse, confirms this. The chapter addresses issues specific to the ecclesia, to the Christian community. How often should one forgive a brother? Matthew 18 verses 21 to 22. What is the procedure for excommunicating someone? Matthew 18 verses 15 to 20. These and other ecclesiastical questions merit attention precisely at this point because Jesus has just established his church. End quote. It is clear that Matthew has integrated all this into Mark's narrative. Mark seems unaware of any of it. It thus would appear to reflect needs and interests subsequent to Mark, or developed during his generation in a community separate from his, which means none of these things happened, and Jesus never said any of it. Illustrating every point made so far is the Sermon on the Mount, which is a well-crafted literary work that cannot have come from some illiterate Galilean. In fact, we know it originated in Greek, not Hebrew or Aramaic, because it relies on the Septuagint text of the Bible for all its features and allusions. It relies extensively on the Greek text of Deuteronomy and Leviticus especially, and in key places on other texts. For example, the section on turning the other cheek and other aspects of legal pacifism, Matthew 5 verses 38 to 42, has been redacted from the Greek text of Isaiah 50 verses 6 to 9. These are not the words of Jesus. This famous sermon as a whole also has a complex literary structure that can only have come from a writer, not an everyday speaker. And again, it reflects needs and interests that would have arisen after the apostles began preaching the faith and organizing communities and struggling to keep them in the fold. So it's unlikely to come from Jesus. Once again, Dale Allison has thoroughly demonstrated many of these points. In particular, he reveals its extensive and brilliant use of triadic structure. It starts with A, the introduction, where crowds ascend the mountain, then moves to B, a recounting of the nine blessings, 3 times 3, then moves to C, a summary statement about salt and light, then moves to D, the central unit of the three pillars of the blessed life, then back to C, another summary statement, this time the golden rule, then back to B, the three warnings, paralleling the nine blessings, then back to A, the conclusion, where the crowd descends from the mountain. Within that overall structure, the central unit, D, then has the most elaborate structure. It is comprised of recounting the three pillars of the blessed life. 1, how to obey the Torah. 2, how to pay cult to God. And 3, how to deal with society. The first and last pillars are, in parallel, broken down into two units, A and B, each with three subjects. And before those units, in one way or another, is a summary of general principles. So for how to obey the Torah, in Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 to 48, we get a summary of general principles in verses 17 to 20. Then section A follows with three subjects: murder in verses 21 to 26, adultery in verses 27 to 30, and divorce in verses 31 to 32. Then section B follows with its three subjects: oaths in verses 33 to 37, vengeance in verses 38 to 42, and loving your enemies in verses 43 to 48. Likewise, for how to deal with society, in Matthew chapter 6, verse 19 to chapter 7, verse 12, we get section A, started with a summary of general principles about storing up treasure in heaven in verses 19 to 21, then three subjects, the I parable in verses 22 to 23, the value parable, God before mammon, in verse 24, and encouragement in verses 25 to 34. Then we get section B, started with a summary of general principles about not judging others in chapter 7 verses 1 to 2. Then again, three subjects, this time paralleling section A. Another I parable in verses 3 to 5. Another value parable, this time the one about pearls before swine in verse 6. And another bout of encouragement in verses 7 to 11. Those two pillars are then wrapped around a third, the central pillar. How to pay cult to God, in Matthew chapter 6, verses 1 to 18. This also starts with a summary of general principles in verse 1, then breaks into just three subjects, two surrounding again, one in the very middle, which is itself broken into three sections. That central subject is the center of the entire discourse on the Mount, and thus the center of the gospel teaching itself. The three subjects here are almsgiving in verses 2 to 4, prayer in verses 5 to 15, and fasting in verses 16 to 18. The central subject of the whole discourse is thus prayer, and this is elaborated into another three sections. The first is about not praying as the hypocrites or Gentiles do in verses 5 to 8. The second recounts the Lord's Prayer in verses 9 to 13, and the third is about forgiveness in verses 14 to 15. The whole discourse thus centers on the Lord's Prayer, which is at the exact middle of all these concentric layers. That section is itself again broken down into three parts. First, the introduction and address in verse 9, then three thou petitions in verses 9 to 10, and then three we petitions in verses 11 to 13. This puts God at the exact center of the entire discourse, the thou petitions being the exact middle section of the exact middle subject of the exact middle pillar, which is in between the two summary statements, around which are the blessings on the one side and the warnings on the other, around which are the introduction and ascent, and the conclusion and descent. This is simply far too elegant, too intricately organized, and too obviously literary to be a casual speech. It is from beginning to end a written product, carefully thought out and painstakingly arranged. It's far more likely that Matthew wrote this himself than that he just extracted it from some other text, a text for some reason no one bothered to preserve. Allison also shows that this Sermon on the Mount fits neatly within known rabbinical debates over how Jews could still fulfill the Torah after the destruction of the temple cult. The general consensus among the rabbis was that good deeds now fulfill that role, especially acts of love and mercy. That is essentially also what the Sermon on the Mount says. Its solution is even more complete by creating a new kind of worship in simple, humble almsgiving, prayer, forgiveness, and fasting. As Allison points out, quote, Simeon the Just, a rabbi of the Maccabean period, is purported to have declared, quote, upon three things the world standeth, upon Torah, upon temple service, and upon Gemulot Hasidim, end quote. Mishnah Abo 1.2. The two words left untranslated are usually rendered deeds of loving kindness. So Simeon declares that three things matter most, the law, the cult, and social or religious acts of benevolence. Now, the parallel with the Sermon on the Mount is remarkable. Matthew 5 to 7 addresses three fundamental issues, the law, the cult, and social behavior. That is, it addresses the three things upon which, according to Simeon the Just, the world stands, and it addresses them in precisely the same order. Thus, it seems Matthew arranged his discourse so as to create a Christian interpretation of the three classical pillars, end quote. Notably, it does this by simply assuming the temple cult doesn't exist. At no point does Jesus in this very long speech explain what to do about the temple sacrifice code in Leviticus or Deuteronomy, for example. Even to reject it or avoid it, or that it isn't needed. To the contrary, the speech simply assumes that's no longer an issue. In other words, it assumes the temple cult has already been destroyed, which means this speech was written after 70 AD. It does not come from Jesus. In addition to all that, Matthew adds details that make Jesus more into a new Moses. Scholars have long known, for example, that Matthew's nativity narrative is a rewrite of the nativity of Moses, drawing not only on Exodus, but on its first century expansion in the anonymous biblical antiquities, and that Matthew has Jesus deliver his new commandments on a mountain, in the Sermon on the Mount, to emulate Moses delivering the commandments of God from Mount Sinai. And in Matthew, Jesus' great commission from a mountain is designed to echo in several respects Moses' great commission before he ascended a mountain to die in Deuteronomy 31-34. And the five great discourses delivered by Jesus are obviously meant to replace the five books of the Pentateuch, which were believed to be written by Moses. This does not mean each discourse corresponds to a specific book in the Torah. Many have tried to force such interpretations, but it is clear no one-to-one correspondence was intended. These five new discourses are simply the new Torah, reinterpreting the old. There are many instances like this of Matthew's literary historical revisionism. For example, Matthew expands Jesus' 40-day sojourn in the wilderness and temptation by the devil, an event already in Mark evoking the 40 years of temptation in the wilderness of Moses and the Jews, into an elaborate parable in which Jesus undergoes the exact same temptations as the Jews, but unlike them, Jesus conveniently passes every test with flying colors, thus reversing the bad mojo their previous failure had cursed the Jews with. Accordingly, quote, Israel was in the wilderness for 40 years, Deuteronomy 8:2. Jesus is there for 40 days, Matthew 4:2. Israel was tempted by hunger and fed upon manna, Exodus 16:2-8. The hungry Jesus, Matthew 4:2, is tempted to turn stones into bread, Matthew 4:3-4. Israel was tempted to put God to the test, Exodus 17:1-3. The same thing happens to Jesus, Matthew 4:6-7. And just as Israel was lured into idolatry in Exodus 32, so the devil confronts Jesus with the same temptation to worship something other than Israel's God, Satan himself, Matthew 4:8-10, end quote. Those are the words of Dale Allison. I should also add that Matthew also has Jesus become more like Moses here by having Jesus fast for 40 days and 40 nights, Matthew 4:2, just as Moses did on Mount Sinai. Exodus 34:28. Matthew has thus invented a narrative and put words in Jesus' mouth all to create a literary symbolic episode involving an obviously fictional event out of what began as a brief line also invented by Mark. This is not history. This is myth-making. That Mark or his lost source invented the temptation is obvious from how it has Jesus reverse the role of the Jews in the Exodus before beginning his own spiritual conquest of the Holy Land. While they wander 40 years in the wilderness before crossing the Jordan to enter the Holy Land, Jesus departs the Holy Land to cross the Jordan and spend 40 days in that same wilderness. And as the Jews there endured trials and receive miraculous aid, so does Jesus. Another indication is the fact that devils and angels don't exist, much less tempt and minister to people in deserts. That only happens in myths. There is in fact no way to discern what, if anything, Matthew has added to Mark has any historical basis, or even a source, and its having a source would still in no way establish that it's historical. After all, Mark is one of Matthew's sources, and Mark's tales are not historical. The same conclusion must therefore follow for Matthew that we reached for Mark. Nothing in it is any less likely on myth than on historicity. It therefore has no evidential value. The burden is therefore on anyone who would insist there is anything in Matthew that is any more authentic than what's in Mark. As it is, I deem Matthew to be just as fictional, showing a wanton readiness to fabricate, and no signs of any interest in historical truth or any ability to discern it, or any indication he has employed any sources more reliable than Mark. Matthew's value for determining historicity is therefore nil. Even if any historical facts about Jesus are in it, we have no way to identify them. Section 6. The Mythology of Luke. Luke is the first gospel to overtly represent itself as history. Matthew comes close by suggesting that the things he says happened fulfilled scripture, but that could still have lent itself to an allegorical reading. Luke, however, writes like a historian, adding superficial historical details as local color and attempting to date some events and even including an albeit vague preface explaining what he is doing by writing. Luke also creates a resurrection narrative that is engineered to answer skeptics of Matthew's account, a tactic that requires his story to be true, although on this count we know it is a fabrication. No prior gospel, nor Paul, had ever heard of the peculiar and convenient details that suddenly make their first appearance in Luke, such as that Peter double-checked the woman's claim that the tomb was empty and handled the burial shroud, or that Jesus showed the disciples his wounds and made sure the disciples touched him and fed him food to prove he wasn't a ghost, or that the resurrected Jesus actually hung out and partied with dozens of his followers for over a month before flying up into the clouds of heaven. That these are all fabrications is obvious from the fact that Paul would have known and made use of them were they known claims of his time, and Mark and Matthew would likewise have known of them and could hardly have failed to mention any of them. So we know Luke is making a lot of things up in order to deliberately sell a fake history, for purposes of winning an argument against doubters, both within and without Christianity, as his opponents included, for example, Christians with very different ideas about the nature of the resurrection. This already warns us not to trust anything he has added to the story found in Mark and Matthew. We should assume it is, like those, a convenient fabrication invented for some purpose, unless we can find sufficient evidence to believe otherwise. In accord with this conclusion, despite his pretense at being a historian, preface and all, Luke's methods are demonstrably non-historical. He is not doing research, weighing facts, checking them against independent sources, and writing down what he thinks most likely happened. He is simply producing an expanded and redacted literary hybrid of a couple of previous religious novels, Matthew and Mark, each itself even more obviously constructed according to literary conventions rather than historiographical, as I've shown in the preceding sections of this chapter. Unlike other historians of even his own era, Luke never names his sources or explains why we are to trust them, or why he did, or how he chose what to include or exclude. In fact, Luke does not even declare any critical method at all, but rather insists that he slavishly followed what was handed on to him. Yet another claim we know to be a lie, since we have two of his sources and can confirm he freely altered them to suit his own agenda. I thoroughly discuss the meaning of Luke's preface and compare him to other historians of his own time in how he constructs and argues for his version of events in Chapter 7 of my book, Not the Impossible Faith. As I mentioned in Chapter 7, the more popular view is that Luke did not redact Matthew, but in fact used a hypothetical source in common with Matthew, now called Q. It is time for this theory to be discarded. It has no merit. It is no longer reasonably deniable that Luke knew and used Matthew as a source directly, and if he did that, there is no basis left for supposing there was any other source involved. The evidence for Luke's extensive reliance on and purposeful redaction of Matthew is documented in the works of Goodacre, Golder, and MacDonald. It should already have been clear that Luke deliberately transformed Matthew's nativity and passion narratives and Matthew's account of Judas's suicide, sometimes even repeating Matthew's Greek verbatim or borrowing heavily from it. For example, Mark 14, verse 65 reads, quote, "And some began to spit on him, and to cover his face, and to buffet him, and to say to him, Prophecy!" which Matthew 26, verse 67-68 expanded into, quote, "Then did they spit in his face and buffet him, and some smote him with the palms of their hands, saying, Prophecy unto us, Christ, who is he that struck thee?" End quote. Luke 22, verses 63-64 essentially combines Mark with Matthew, repeating the concluding text of Matthew verbatim. Quote, "And the men that held Jesus mocked him and beat him, and they blindfolded him and asked him, saying, Prophecy, who is he that struck thee?" End quote. Except for dropping, quote, "unto us, Christ," end quote, to economize the passage, the Greek of Luke here is identical to that of Matthew. Luke then combines this with Mark's detail that they covered his eyes, which Matthew omitted, or rather altered, having them spit in his face rather than cover his face. Luke thus combined Mark with Matthew, recast mostly but not entirely in his own words, to make what he deemed to be a better passage. That Luke knows the details Matthew added, and even borrows his exact words, is sufficient proof that Luke knew and used Matthew. Note that on no theory of Q is this element of the passion narrative a part of Q, so this cannot be explained by appealing to Q. Luke is using Matthew, and if here, so everywhere. there is simply no need of an imaginary cue. There are likewise many places where Matthew redacts a passage in Mark and Luke follows the Greek of Matthew rather than Mark, showing that Luke knew Matthew and occasionally preferred Matthew's version to Mark's original. Another example, Luke redacts Matthew's Sermon on the Mount, conspicuously reversing it into a sermon on a plain. How do we know Luke is redacting Matthew? Because both speeches are followed by the otherwise unrelated narrative of Jesus healing the centurion's son in Capernaum. The latter occurs in Matthew 8, verses 5 to 13, the sermon having ended at 8:1. Only a brief healing of a leper lies in between. Luke 6, verses 17 to 49, redacts that sermon, and then immediately in Luke 7, the centurion's servant is healed in Capernaum. The story, in many respects identical, even down to specific words and phrases, such as revising the centurion's son into the centurion's boy, which some translators render as servant, but in context, this is obviously just a different way of saying son. Likewise, Matthew 4, verse 23 to Matthew 5, verse 1 precedes the sermon with a general account of Jesus healing many, and Luke 6, verses 17 to 19 does the same thing. These parallels are very improbable unless Luke was following and redacting Matthew's narrative, unless Q was an actual complete narrative gospel with the same exact sequence of events written in Greek. But as we've already seen, there is no need of that overcomplicated hypothesis and plenty of evidence against it. That Luke redacted Matthew does not mean he always simply copied or paraphrased him. He creatively redacts Matthew and often deliberately reverses his themes, as when Luke converts the Sermon on the Mount into a sermon on a plain. More conspicuously, when Luke rewrites Matthew's nativity narrative, he conspicuously reverses almost all of its key elements. Whereas Matthew depicts Jesus' family as essentially outlaws, fleeing Bethlehem and Herod's rule and cowering abroad for over a decade, Luke describes Jesus' family as obeying the law and going to Bethlehem in accordance with their emperor's command. And while Matthew has Herod searching to kill the baby Jesus, Luke has Jesus being presented in the Jerusalem temple to repeated public announcements of his messianic status by the prophets Anna and Simeon, an event that would not have escaped Herod's supposedly murderous eye or memory, nor that of his agents and informants. And then Luke has Jesus' family living dutifully in their home at Nazareth the whole while, the period when Matthew has them hiding in Egypt. And Luke keeps bringing Jesus back to Jerusalem for the Passover every single year without fail, in full compliance with Levitical law. Luke thus deliberately changed the reason Jesus was born in Bethlehem but came from Nazareth, an aim first attempted in Matthew. It's an unlikely coincidence that Luke would attempt the same harmonization unless he knew Matthew had started this Bethlehem tradition. There are many other unlikely coincidences, for example, in the way angels send essentially the same messages to Joseph and Mary in both accounts, and the fact that both accounts involve an annunciation, a virgin birth, and a genealogy, displaced in Luke but still there, displacement of elements like this being a common procedure in Luke. Even the annunciations, for example, are too similar to be chance coincidence. Both Matthew and Luke have an angel report that Mary will conceive and bear a son. They shall name him Jesus, and he shall be something great. The same three-part announcement, in the same order, with the middle phrase identically the same. And you will call his name Jesus. Luke, having copied Matthew at that point, verbatim. His changes, such as that the angel reports to Mary rather than Joseph, or phrasing the same things in different words, or expanding what the angel says, do not disguise the fact that Luke is clearly redacting Matthew. He is not coming up with these things independently of him. Many of the differences are also just as improbable if they weren't intentional. For Luke, the family of Jesus is always obedient to religious and secular law and is never in danger and never hiding in a foreign country. Similarly, Luke erased the involvement of foreigners, the Persian magi, and replaced them with, evidently Jewish, shepherds, and replaced Matthew's magical star informing the magi with an angelic light from heaven informing the shepherds. Luke clearly did not approve of Matthew's version of events, and thus changed them all around to fix the story as Luke preferred. His changes then created a historical contradiction between the Gospels. Luke's story entails Jesus was born in 6 AD. Matthew's entails Jesus was born before 4 BC, as I demonstrate in my book, Hitler, Homer, Bible, Christ. There are many other respects in which it is clear Luke is borrowing ideas and material from Matthew and deliberately changing others, in effect to correct or fix Matthew, as many scholars have shown. In much the same way, Luke borrowed and deliberately changed Matthew's tale of the death of Judas, inserting it into Acts 1 verses 16 to 20, and replaced Matthew's genealogy with Luke's own. Luke cannot have been getting these things from Q, which did not include nativities, genealogies, or Judas's suicide. Luke must have been redacting Matthew, even if freely, as redactions often were. It is fallacious to assume a redaction must be literal or verbatim or line by line. Many scholars have argued that Luke aimed to unify the two major divided factions of Christianity, the Gentile and Torah observant sects, and his account across Luke and Acts revises history to tell a tale of continuous harmony between them, while simultaneously portraying Jesus and Christianity as a valid, devout, law-abiding philosophical sect respected by the Romans and opposed only by a faction of the hard-lined Jewish elite, as I noted again in chapter 9. Luke is thus in effect a rebuttal to Matthew, just as Matthew was an attempted rebuttal to Mark. Mark promoted Gentile Christianity. Matthew promoted Torah-observant Christianity. Luke promotes a harmonious church, one that is a good and faithful evolution of Judaism into what is essentially, but carefully never said to be, the Gentile church. So Luke not only borrows and redacts extensively from Matthew and Mark, who we've seen are not exactly reliable sources of history, but he also makes changes and additions that conveniently suit his own purposes and that were conspicuously unknown to Matthew or Mark, suggesting that his aims were also more literary than historically reliable. Indeed, Luke's additions are often not plausible and look self-evidently like embellishments of the kind one would expect for a work like this, pretending at being history, but reinforcing the author's rhetorical aims by creating better stories, better models, or better evidence in support of them. Luke's evident use of Josephus, as I noted in chapter 7, only reinforces this conclusion. Likewise, his use of Homer as a model for some of his stories. But clinching it is how much of the material that Luke adds to Mark and Matthew is demonstrably fabricated by essentially rewriting the Elijah-Elisha narrative in 1 and 2 Kings, just as we saw Mark had done, casting Jesus in the central role and updating the details to fit the conditions of Roman Palestine. This last point has been extensively demonstrated by Thomas Brody, as I noted in chapter 9. The parallels are sometimes direct and sometimes inversions, where Luke takes what is in the King's narrative and reverses it, or key elements of it, and are too numerous and distinct to be chance coincidence. Luke, or his source for this material, if he did not invent it himself, is thus creating a literary myth by reworking the Old Testament, not by recording historical facts passed down to him by witnesses. Examples include Luke 1, verses 5 to 17, reverses 1 Kings 16 verse 29 to 17 verse 1. Luke 7 verses 1 to 10 transforms 1 Kings 17 verses 1 to 6. Luke 7 verses 11 to 17 transforms 1 Kings 17 verses 17 to 24. Luke 7 verses 18 to 25 transforms 1 Kings 22. Luke 7 36 to 50 plays on 2 Kings 4 1 to 37. Luke 8, 1-3, plays on 1 Kings 18. Luke 9, 51-56, transforms 2 Kings 1, verse 1, to 2 Kings 2, verse 6. Luke 9, verses 57-62, transforms 1 Kings 19. Luke 10, 1-20, transforms 2 Kings 2, verse 16, to 2 Kings 3, verse 27. And Luke 22-24 adapts elements from 2 Kings 2, verses 7-15. To illustrate what I mean, I'll focus on two examples from this list which typify the rest. In Luke 7, verses 11-17, we learn of a new story not found in Matthew or Mark, the healing of the widow's son at Nain. This story is already intrinsically dubious. The elements of drama and the miraculous in it are typical of fictions, not realities, and this kind of story was a trope at the time, essentially the same tale as told of the medical doctor Asclepiades by Apuleius a few decades later, and similar tales were referenced by Pliny the Elder before Luke even put pen to paper. It has the air of an urban legend, a standard tale retold a dozen times of different people in different places, but always coincidentally the same improbable story that we conveniently never hear of from an eyewitness. But what further demonstrates this particular version of the tale as a fiction is that it is just a rewrite of the same legend told of Elijah in the first book of Kings. Here are the parallels, all of which Luke literarily modifies, merges, or improves in various ways. In 1 Kings 17, the story starts with, "It happened after this." Luke 7 starts with nearly the same phrase, "It happened afterwards." In 1 Kings 17, we hear that at the gate of Sarepta, Elijah meets a widow. In Luke 7, at the gate of Nain, Jesus meets a widow. In 1 Kings 17, another widow's son is dead. In Luke 7, this widow's son is dead. In 1 Kings 17, that widow expresses a sense of her unworthiness on account of sin. In Luke 7, a centurion, whose boy Jesus had just saved from death, had just expressed a sense of his unworthiness on account of sin. In 1 Kings 17, Elijah compassionately bears her son up the stairs and asks the Lord why he was allowed to die. Luke 7 says the Lord feels compassion for her and touches her son's bier, and the bearers stand still. In 1 Kings 17, Elijah prays to the Lord for the son's return to life. In Luke 7, the Lord commands the boy to rise. In 1 Kings 17, the boy comes to life and cries out. In Luke 7, and he who was dead sat up and began to speak. In 1 Kings 17, the phrase, "and he gave him to his mother," appears. In Luke 7, the exact same phrase, "and he gave him to his mother," appears. In 1 Kings 17, the widow recognizes Elijah is a man of God and that the word he speaks is the truth. In Luke 7, the people recognize Jesus as a great prophet of God and the word of his truth spreads everywhere. The giveaway here is Luke's use of the exact same clause, verbatim, as the Septuagint text of the Elijah story, quote, "and he gave him to his mother," end quote, every word identical and in identical order. This fact, combined with all the other obvious parallels, indicates that literary borrowing has occurred. The links are simply too improbable otherwise. Even some of the differences are too coincidental to be probable as anything but a deliberate transformation of the emulated tale. There are many respects, in fact, in which Luke sees himself as improving on the original story. For example, Thomas Brodie observes that with several of the changes Luke makes, there is a fundamental change in the message the story conveys. Quote, "Whereas in the Old Testament text, the sense of sinfulness leads to a kind of despair, to an idea that the man of God is a bothersome visitor who comes to punish with death. In the New Testament text, the sense of unworthiness is combined with a profound faith, with an immense reverence for the Lord, and also with a clear conviction that despite one's unworthiness, the Lord comes to heal, to save from the encroachment of death." In other words, the Old Testament picture of God visiting the sin of a mother on her child is replaced by the New Testament image of the life-giving Lord as looking not on one's unworthiness, but on one's faith, end quote. Likewise, while the Old Testament version suggests, quote, that the Lord is the author of evil, the one who brings harm to the widow, end quote, the New Testament version suggests God is the one who comforts and heals instead, and so on. Brodie's analysis goes on to highlight the obvious rationale behind the many changes Luke makes, but the differences are partly the point. They are made on purpose, and partly just a common effect of creativity. A talented author does not slavishly duplicate, but transforms and varies a literary tale. In the case of Luke 9, emulating 2 Kings 1, there are even more direct verbatim and near-verbatim lifts of Greek from the Septuagint, as well as numerous parallels and deliberate changes and reversals. And both accounts have the same five-part structure: a plan of death and assumption into heaven, ascending of messengers, the messengers being turned back, mention of calling down fire from heaven upon those who rejected them, then journeying from one place to another. Luke is thus expanding on Matthew and Mark by adding made-up stories rewritten from the Old Testament. As Brodie explains, quote, "Such similarities are striking, particularly when they occur in essentially the same order. What is doubly striking, however, is that three of the five sections, the first, second, and fourth, contain elements that are unique in the entire Greek Bible. Nowhere else, save in these passages, does one find a picture of someone setting off for an assumption, a combining of and he sent messengers with the Greek word poruomai and an image of calling down fire from heaven. In addition to these unique similarities are other significant similarities of detail, some of them intriguing. The differences are great. In comparison with Luke, the Old Testament text is long and repetitive. Furthermore, it involves not just one main character, but two, King Ahaziah and Elijah. And it sets the image of departing for Assumption not at the beginning of the death-related episode, but after its conclusion. However, though the differences are indeed great, they are not jumbled or incoherent, at odds with one another and with all known literary procedures. On the contrary, they correspond to steady patterns of adaptation, such as modernization, abbreviation, fusion, and emulation, patterns which are common both in general imitation and in other instances where Luke imitates the Old Testament. Since these differences may be explained through the procedures of imitation, they may not be invoked to prove that imitation was not used. End quote. Not only did Luke lift story ideas from the King's narratives, he also emulated several other Old Testament books. Luke's nativity story for John the Baptist is in part based on the nativity of Samson told in the biblical Antiquities, an anonymous first century elaboration on the Bible. Mary's song, now often called the Magnificat, in Luke 1 verses 46 to 55, is based on Hannah's song in 1 Samuel 2, 1 to 10. Even the names he selects have rather convenient literary meanings. Elizabeth means God's promise, and Zechariah means God has remembered. Thus, it is rather conspicuous that Mary's song of praise references both God's remembering and promising. Quote, "He has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy, according to the promise he made to our ancestors," end quote. Which is the fabrication? The song or the names of John's parents? Probably both. Other examples include the fact that Luke portrays Jesus as the new temple by echoing elements of the birth of the temple in 1 Chronicles 21 to 22 in elements of the birth of Jesus in Luke 2 verses 1 to 20, including even the role of an imperial decree. Luke's literary structure is more ad hoc than Matthew's or Mark's because he is attempting to interweave so many components. Many scholars have found evidence of literary structures in Luke that are occasionally interrupted with additional material, suggesting what may be the haphazard expansion of sources or an earlier version of Luke's text that were even more obviously fictional. For example, Brody has identified a conspicuous structure in the material borrowing from the Elijah-Elisha narrative, making an 8-part diptych, which could be proof that Luke used a source, a previous gospel unrelated to the others, that was fabricated to make Jesus into the new Elijah. For example, the first section of 8 consists of Jesus' infancy narrative, which has the 2-part diptych structure of annunciations and then births. Yet even that structure is composed of further diptychs. John's birth is foretold, then John is born. Jesus' birth is foretold, then Jesus is born. Then another diptych of visits is formed with numerous parallel elements. Mary is visited by an angel, then journeys to Judah, meeting Elizabeth, an old woman who breaks into prophecy, and then circumcises and names her own child, John, on the 8th day after his birth. A sequence repeated again when shepherds are visited by an angel and visit Mary, then Mary journeys to Jerusalem, meeting Anna, an old woman who breaks into prophecy, and Mary circumcises and names her own child, Jesus, on the 8th day after his birth. Each of the 3 diptychs is increasingly more complex than the last, but all fit within the overarching diptych of annunciation, then birth, ending with circumcision, but doubled, one sequence for John, one for Jesus, with the 3rd diptych establishing the theme of Jesus' supremacy to John. Throughout, the continuous theme is obedience to the law. Similar structures track all of Luke's lifts from the King's narratives, such that if one extracted those from the rest of Luke and Acts, one has a very elegant and consistent repeating diptych structure. Brody argues that that would be unlikely unless these tales originally existed together and Luke only broke them apart to intersperse them into his narrative. Luke often creates dispersed diptychs, as I noted in chapter 9, for example. So that might have simply been the way he composed. I am thus not here affirming Brody's theory is correct, only that it is worth examining, although even if incorrect, his same evidence confirms Luke's compositional style as one of creating paired events, even if not adjacent to each other, which is evidence of fiction either way. Note that this same observation applies to all other studies that find structure in Luke, but are then uncertain because it is interrupted. interrupting structure appears to be particularly Lucan, which means either the structure comes from better organized mythic texts that Luke has added to, or Luke constructed his own organization and then edited in more material. Fiction, either way. That Luke appears to have been multiply redacted may have significance here. Like John, our text of Luke may have undergone numerous editorial stages. But again, either way, it only confirms the same point, that Luke is not writing history, but myth. He or his sources are simply making everything up. His tales are told for their meaning and rhetorical effect, not because they were researched or came from witnesses. I'll close with one more example of this, the Emmaus narrative of Luke 24, a resurrection appearance tale found in no other gospel, and thus distinctive of Luke's style of invention. Here Luke tells the story of a man named Cleopas, along with an unnamed friend, who journeys by road from Jerusalem to nearby Emmaus, after they learn the corpse of Jesus has vanished. On the way, the resurrected Jesus appears to them, albeit in disguise, and explains the secrets of the kingdom, which happens to be a spiritual kingdom, not a physical one. Then he vanishes, and Cleopas recognizes who he was and goes on to proclaim what he was told. Conveniently, the name Cleopas means tell all, in other words, proclaim. Cleopas is occasionally claimed to be a contraction of Cleopatras, which means renowned father, but there is no need of that hypothesis when the apposite meaning is clear. The deliberate combination of Cleo, glory, fame, report, and pas, all, everything. There are few precedents for such a name, as a contraction or otherwise. It thus appears to be Luke's invention. In extant literature, Cleopas as a name is mentioned only later by the 2nd century grammarian Aelius Herodianus, but he does not identify it as a contraction of Cleopatras, and he doesn't identify anyone as actually having that name. Sometimes hypothetical examples appear in Aelius. Aelius says that, quote, every phrase deriving from the syllable kle is written with a bare epsilon, for example, kleos as in doxa, in other words, glory, opinion, reputation, and klesdo in speaking as in doxasdo, in other words, to extol. And the following proper names derive from the same word, kleon, kleonikos, Cleopatras, and Cleopas, end quote. Thus, we should infer that kleon, from kleo plus os, means glorious, reputable, extolled. Kleonikos, from kleo plus nikos, means famous victory. Cleopatras, from kleo and patros, means renowned father. And so Cleopas, from kleo and pas, means all glorious, everywhere famed, or proclaiming all. The story in Luke thus has several telltale markers of myth, a name invented or selected for its meaning to the tale rather than any historical truth, an absurdly ahistorical narrative never heard of from any other source, of a disguised divine visitor, an unrealistic conversation with a complete stranger, a miraculous vanishing, and an all-too-convenient rhetorical purpose for all of it. This is the vanishing hitchhiker legend, ancient Roman style. The vanishing hitchhiker is a commonly replicated ghost story found in many forms across several centuries. For scholarly analysis, see Jan Harald Brunvand, The Vanishing Hitchhiker. For an analogous, oft-replicated ghost story, The Revenant Lover, which illustrates the general features of such legends, such as the presence of details designed to make the story sound authentic, you simply cannot claim the Emmaus story rings true until you notice how all ghost legends do. See William Hansen's Phlegon of Troll's Book of Marvels, where he shows the story was later recast in early modern Ireland, complete with all the same details aimed at authenticity, only altered to sound authentic to its new setting, thus illustrating how legends actually get composed. As it happens, the founding myth of Rome, then famously known everywhere and celebrated in annual passion plays, is almost the exact same story. A man named Proculus, archaic Latin for proclaimer or he who proclaims, thus not only again a fictional name designed for the story, but essentially the same name as Cleopas, journeys by road from nearby Alba Longa to Rome, after the Roman people learn the corpse of Romulus has vanished, and on the way, the resurrected Romulus appears to him, not in disguise in this case, but this time in glorious form, and explains the secrets of the kingdom, literally, in other words, how to conquer and rule the world. Then he ascends into heaven, as Luke eventually has Jesus do as well, and Proculus recognizes who he was and goes on to proclaim what he was told. I've already demonstrated the extent to which the Gospels have borrowed this Romulan resurrection tale for Jesus in chapter 4 and again in element 47. Mark had already fashioned his passion account in light of it, and Matthew embellished it even more in accord. So it is not unexpected that Luke would take the same model further. And indeed he has. Not only in the ways I have already pointed out in previous chapters, but also here in the tale of Cleopas on the road to Emmaus. If we accept the identification of Luke's intended Emmaus as the Emmaus mentioned by Josephus as a town near